Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see. Nothing to see. Nothing to see.
You are listening to Nothing to See Here, a program of experimental radio produced at NASCAD University. This episode is entitled Other People.
But since you're here...
Okay, we are here.
You're people.
We are people.
Sort of.
Sort of.
We yes. try. But you're both people who are interested in not being people.
Oh, are we?
Oh.
Damien? I can confirm, but I don't know about yourself.
I'm interested in the way people define what people are.
Well, why don't you introduce who you think you are?
I'm reminded that the Dene people, like if you think of the word Dene, it actually means people.
Yeah.
If you refer to a lot of the anthropological literature, a lot of mm-hmm. people, when they have a tribe, the people is whoever they know. And the non-people are the people they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
My problem is I don't know if I'm a people.
So maybe you should introduce that person.
Who? Damien?
Yeah.
But yeah. Now I'm being put on the spot, you know, and the impetus of my newfound senility renders me somewhat futile. But
well, see, that was beautiful right there. Okay. I often describe Javé as he's the person who speaks in prose. You really do. I aspire to be able to talk like you. Like it's really impressive.
And Damien is like a prodigy who has the capacity through conjoining logical axioms in incredibly dense ways to make my brain melt under the stress. Like it's sort of like an engineering sag that occurs when it overloads. And then you have to take a sort of step back and assimilate the weight of all these argumentative processes which are aligned pretty meticulously.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. But maybe bringing it back to like the people thing, because that's a great topic. That's actually a pattern that anthropologists noticed, is that like the word for whichever, we could say society, tribe, clan, etc., you know, grouping of people, the word used to refer to the collective typically was, you know, a synonym for their word for, you know, person.
Mm.
Right.
Mm.
Right.
Mm.
Right.
Mm.
Right. Right.
Mm.
Right.
Mm.
Right. And so for a while, anthropologists, including Levi-Strauss, thought this was an example of anthropocentrism or even ethnocentrism, mm. right? Because it's like you said, well, you know, people are whoever we know and everyone else isn't a person. But it turns out that it's a little bit more nuanced than that, because the definition of person changes what you mean when you say that you're what a person is. If we say that, like, we're the people, right, then that's relative to the set of things that we include in that category. So the kind of big revolutionary turnaround that happened with, like, our anthropologists' understanding of animism was that even though, like, pretty much all these Amazonian tribes were calling themselves people, what they mean by people is undifferentiated across, like, species lines. That it's, like, a continuity of you could say culture among like a discontinuity of form. It's like things are the same on the inside, they have the same kind of soul, they're the same kind of subject, and they occur within different forms, different bodies, different taxonomies, right?
Where would you identify our disconnect from that idea as Western people?
Well, according to an anthropologist that everyone should read called Philip Descola, another really good one is Eduardo Vieira de Castro, who works in Brazil. You can think of it as an inversion. Like it's a direct inversion of animism is what you find in the West. So if animists find a continuity of subjectivity and a discontinuity of physical substance, than what occurs in among Western kind of naturalist ontologies, they would call them, is the opposite, in which things are fundamentally made of the same substance, but what differentiates people, differentiates us from other things that we might hesitate to call people, is the differences in the degrees of consciousness. So we're in the habit of saying, for example, that like we're sentient in a way that animals aren't. And so we literally have an inverted way of integrating experience.
You've had this long performative project with an AI. I'm also interested in if that is a project of this inverted animism.
You mean from the Western perspective?
Yeah, yeah. Like, and to your point, which is that we can never find a dualism between animism and non-animism, perhaps, in culture. I wonder if there's implications for your own kind of work, and maybe this is an opportunity for you to describe that project.
It's a project where I get an artificial intelligent set of algorithms, or I explore how suites of algorithms that are emerging from the large corporations, which are basically mining and harvesting the linguistic output of the multiple populations that embody them, Google and Facebook and Salesforce. Every major corporation is actually in the midst of data mining that, as we all know. And while they have to data mine it, they have to find an analytical framework, and they often release libraries, and these free libraries are very easily usable by a programmer. So I've been using those to write poetry. So now you can take a dense representation of language, and these models that OpenAI, which is Facebook, they've released the most modern sort of Terminator algorithm that was coined in the popular press as being destructive of the capacity of humans to distinguish between machine-generated text versus the normal human autonomous will-based text. But in fact, these models have been released on a six-month schedule, and the 6 months came up yesterday, and at midnight they released their 777 megabyte model. There'll be a model twice that size released in December. So at 6 a.m., you know, yesterday morning, I downloaded this big model and tried to make it run, but it wouldn't fit onto the graphics card that I have. So this project that I have, I'm well aware that even though it seems to link so intimately with the animist tradition, it's so obviously so brittle and so feeble and so unaware. Because it attains a level of capacity at a linguistic level which has never been achieved before. But ironically, it actually suggests that these are really tenuous, ephemeral algorithms. That's simply what they are.
That's simply what they are.
And so I don't know if it's a project investigating animism as much as it's investigating the potential for machines to emulate consciousness.
Well, maybe to kind of go off on one of the things that you said, which I think is true, which is like we don't want to come up with a model of the way that people seem to think, you know, in a kind of behavioral sense, and ascribe that to an understanding of an individual's thoughts, right? So, and maybe a testament to that is the high degree of variability in what we actually believe, you know, on a day-to-day basis. Right, so it's like I've heard you in the past talk about your sympathies for like panpsychism as like a theory, like a theory that might inform your moral decisions, maybe, right? Or a theory that might inform your understanding of the universe. But on the other hand, it's like here you are espousing a kind of cynical understanding of, you know, the possibility of sentient AI, et cetera, right? So a productive way of thinking about these kind of things might just be that, like, there are particular modes of thought, right? Animism is a mode of thought.
Yes.
Which organizes our experience in terms of similarity and difference in an inverted way to the, we could say, the modes that are doctrinal in the West, right? Mm. But it's one that's certainly accessible to us and very intuitive, right?
Oh, yeah.
Very, very intuitive. Like, we kick printers when they aren't working. Mm. And we, as children, we love our stuffed animals. Right? Like, animistic thinking is very accessible to us in some ways.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Well.
The magic of animism being the magic of not just endowing, but knowing at a deep and fundamental level that this companion creature has exactly the attributes that you feel within yourself, some sort of vulnerability and sensitivity and caring.
Right, and we can differentiate that in a very kind of meaningful sense from, like, say, an animist tradition.
Right.
Which is like an explicit set of beliefs that are canonical and that are embodied in ritual and are identifiable in a historical sense, right?
Formalized, rule-based ritual structures.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. 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 Exactly. What do I think of panpsychism? Yeah. Well, I think that panpsychism is I think it's I think it's a bit of a cop-out, right? So
by cop-out, you mean a failure of intellect to really, really diligently approach an analytical problem?
Right. So it's like, there's an idea that I do think is true, which is that, like, if a question can't be answered, it's not a question. It's just a nonsensical statement, right? But I don't think we're ready to actually ignore the hard question of consciousness yet.
Mm.
And that's why I don't think we can move past it, right? So we have, like, this epistemological problem. Right, which is that we don't know how to verify whether or not something has consciousness. And what that means is that right now we can't actually validate or invalidate statements such as panpsychism. Mm. It's like there's no real way of ascertaining whether or not the fabric of the universe is conscious. Right. Well,
parts of it, maybe, you know.
Sure. And so the justifications for panpsychism that I've typically heard, if they're not being done for, say, like, spiritual reasons, are ones that try to get around the problem of emergence, right? So I've had conversations with a Gust. He's a friend of mine. He was a fellow here last year. He's very interested in the emergence of, say, life from matter, sentience from non-sentience, like awareness from unaware matter, we could say, right? The emergence of perception, essentially. And panpsychism gets you out of that bind by claiming that perception is this imbued in everything. And so I just kind of see that as dodging the question.
But there's multiple versions of this particular, you know, it's an entire spectrum. And if you see the spectrum of awareness could be, or sentience as we know it, could be such an extreme structure that we're growing towards something, even as human beings, we're in an interim state. Sentience of rocks is maybe just a different kind of sentience. It's not necessarily the thing that we associate with, like, go shopping, fall asleep, have a snack. You know, they're in a different mode, a different temporal reasoning structure. But maybe there's some of the fundamentals. I think that's what some panpsychists would say, is that the fundamental attributes of sentience can be found at a trickle-down level, at a faint reservoir reverberation in the core of the molecules of a mineral. Is a clinging to each other that emulates home, that is a family, that is a knot, that is a node of quartz, that is feldspar. This itself is a belonging.
Do you worry that that's just kind of like an anthropomorphic projection?
It might be, but how are we to know that what we have here, I think the notion that something is anthro is to just try to sort of chain it off within the sapiens. Well, everything is preserved across the evolutionary vertebrates. Mm-hmm. right? All of the neurological nodes, most like the capacity to feel, to have nocioreceptors. We've talked about that a lot before. I really feel that that is a strong continuum, stronger than the continuum of like sapiens versus all the other mammalian species in the world. It feels to me a little false.
Right, so, but then you see how this gets counterintuitive, because, like, now suddenly it's humble to believe that our perception is what the universe is made of, right?
No, I'm not saying our perception. I'm saying that aspects of our perception might prove to be core fundamentals, which permeate all of the reservoir of everything else that is. And that this tentative, ephemeral, struggling, flickering sense we have of being here, of being meta-aware, of being a subjective self, is an ephemeral instantation in a very chaotic universe, but uses some core primitives, like psychocognitive primitives, in the same way if it was a sphere or a pyramid or a isocadecahedron or whatever those are, right? So this is the kind of querying that I think is meaningful. And I do think panpsychism, as I've said to you before, I hold it as a position on the basis that I feel it's ethically relevant, because the Western mindset has amputated us. And it's that amputation which has caused enormous amounts of grief and misery in this world.
Right. No, I just wonder if there could be a way of, like, keeping all of the things that you said, like, all the benefits of panpsychism, but, like, getting out of dualism. Because panpsychism seems to hold on to dualism, doesn't it? Right, like a division between mind and matter, right? And in which it claims that, you know, well, in the same way that the brain is matter, and which contains the mind, well, all matter, not just brains, contain mind in some way. You know, like, the particular benefits that you're talking about with panpsychism, you know, getting out of these kind of paradoxes and contradictions and moral, you know, divisions, it could be done by, you know, just moving past those kind of binaries.
How would you escape the dualism of mind-matter, the core?
Well, we could draw on Wittgenstein again.
Let's do it.
He's a good case for this. One of the things that he kind of tries to demonstrate in the Tractatus is that he claims that we have to admit of a sort of form of solipsism, a solipsism that coincides with realism. And he does it in a very clever way, which is basically that if we make the claim, and this is the sort of problem of infinite regress that dualists always run into, if we make the claim that, you know, language refers to something and describes something, then it has to describe something that can exist in a state of not being described. So now what we've done is we've characterized the mental domain as the domain that involves description, and the material domain as the one that's described. But of course, as soon as you try to start characterizing the domain that isn't described, you started describing it, right? In fact, the description of two domains is itself a description. So now that's the problem of infinite regress, right? And the element of contradiction, which is the second nail in the coffin that he identifies, is that by claiming that you're referring to it, you have to actually say something about it, but you set up an impossible criteria. And so, according to Wittgenstein, like the idea of the noumenal realm is meaningless. It doesn't actually refer to anything, and so we have to disavow ourselves, that we have to remain silent, right?
Well, so let's speak to your experiences then about
with what
about absorbing yourself in this kind of othering of language that you know, you're kind of acknowledging it. I think you characterized it as ironically sort of distancing yourself from the possibility that you could ever sort of like sense the consciousness of this corpus that you are, you know, communing with or seancing with.
Well, we all know that famous, like, language is a virus saying of William Burroughs, right? Mm. The notion of, you know, the drug-infested aliens descending from the mothership to
which
to
would have, of course, the Earth. Emerged before the concept of the computer virus, presumably.
Right. Yeah. I think it comes from, like, back long in the mythological fabric, somehow, that fire and language were given to man to kind of convert the world from being this catonic presence and to being a controllable, featured, demarcated, and exploitatable farm, basically, a big, big factory. And this is where it grows from. I personally feel that in particular forms of mind, in particular ways of being, one can arrive at a proximal state to animism that is animism that relates to language as if it were a big quickened ocean, an ocean which permeates minds and grows and spreads its tentacles and feeds on us, rather than the opposite or inverse. And the same way with, like, all of matter itself, like, looking down beneath the quantum scale, down beneath any kind of nano structure that we could ever perceive with granularity and precision with contemporary instrumentation, one can conceive of alternate civilizations which inhabit the slime on the edge of a nano quark or something we don't even know that exists. It's actually a universe in and of itself that is moving at a temporal ratio that's so distinct from our own that we're kind of, we will never know it existed. And that kind of implausibility is for me very fertile terrain. What is language? The murmurings of a stream in the midst of madness.
I'm wondering whether either of you could convince yourself that you don't exist.
Oh, yeah. Man, I think you can.
Let's work on
that. I think you can. But
let's try it.
Right, so, okay.
And that might make silence.
You can, if you have a misapprehension of what you are, I think you can.
Oh.
Right. So, like, this is another attack on dualism that was done by, like, some of the, I think actually Wittgenstein made a similar point, but I think it was better formulated by, like, some perceptual, like, cognitive scientists that were interested in perception. So I think it's called Ryle's problem of regress. So if for example, you're under the assumption that you are something that perceives, right?
I think, therefore, I am.
Right. Yeah, that's where things get tricky. Because then you can say, well, if I'm a thing that perceives, then I should be able to perceive myself, right? So I should be able to at least be able to indicate the thing that's perceiving if I'm a thing that perceives, right? And so then we try to do it, and then when you indicate the thing that's perceiving, then you're perceiving the thing that's perceiving, so the thing is not perceiving any longer, and so you try to do it on the second order, and you know, you go down the I am a strange loop Hofstadter, you know, all that fun stuff, right?
How do you think the thinking? Yeah,
right. And that's how you know, you end up, I think, you know, Wittgenstein, well, this is like halfway through the tractat, no, it's near the end, it's like 5.6 or something. He says, like, you know, there is no such thing as that which perceives, right? And
right, and
right, and right, and what he means isn't that there's no such thing as perception. It's that there isn't a thing that perceives. In other words, it's like just because there's thinking doesn't mean that there's a thing that's doing it. So we can't use the language of things to refer to the phenomena of consciousness.
I think the phrase was, you can't step on your own shadow.
You know, maybe we could, like, rephrase the Descartes thing to this, like, cogito.
And this is actually in agreement with the what one could say is that some, in some esoteric sense, the highest realms of Oriental philosophy, like Prajnaparamita, like the Prajnaparamita Sutras, define that nothing has so substantive self-identity, that everything is in this ephemeral field.
Right.
And the field itself has no identity. And the philosophy itself has no identity. There's nothing to grasp on. There's the unknowability, there's the inconceivability. And I always think of that when I get brought back to the Cogito example, because it feels to me just like a mild, this is like an existential tantrum by a child, where Prajnaparamita says, you don't exist. The phenomenological world does not exist. And even this philosophy which tells you that all this stuff does not exist, does not exist. And to get to that point where it's just Cogito, that's actually the aspirational void that drives millenniums of practitioners to move toward. Somehow it feels like the frothy bubbles on the edge of the pot of humanity go up there and they get cast out into whatever is beyond the surface of the water where we live. And I'm personally applying to leave, but I haven't gotten far.
Waiting on the visa. Yeah.
Waiting on the visa. Interviewing
impenetrable.
He's being he's holding to the duality between interview and
we're getting tricked into making it look like we think we know what we're talking about.
Yeah,
that's what's happening.
Do you have you ever had an experience that you do not exist? Because that's a very tough experience to have.
It is. I'm trying to imagine if I can possibly imagine it, or the dilemma, of course, would I recognize it?
Right? Once one is in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm constantly kind of drawn to the dream state where you seem to have a position, but then, you know, when the experience I really like is when you wake up still thinking that the reality you dreamed was real.
Yes.
And that slow realization and shift that happens when you kind of reorient yourself to outside of the frame of the dream, and you have to kind of like re-believe reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've inherited the reality of the dream.
Articulated that we don't know what
the disappearance.
Where it's going to go.
Oh. That's right, yeah. Yeah, the way we react to prediction error.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
And
just give me your names, just so I have the
credits. David Javadi Johnston.
I am Damien Alender Arteca. How about that?
Alender,
yeah. Actually, fun fact, because you're into linguistics, my dad has spent a large chunk of his life developing his own conlang.
Oh.
And so my middle name is from that.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a fun fact. There you go.
It's very funny. How do you spell it?
A-L-E-N-D-E-R.
You have been listening to Nothing to See Here, a program of experimental radio produced at NASCAD University. This episode was entitled Other People. It features conversations between Damien Arteaga, David Jahav Johnson, and David Clark. The sound design and editing were by David Clark. For more episodes of Nothing to See Here, please search for Nothing to See Here Radio on SoundCloud.com.